Hi, I'm Emma.
I'm Sean.
Welcome back to the third episode of the Blue Side Podcast, the podcast for the Science Communication Society at the University of Cambridge.
On the show today, I talked to Ian Osterreicher from the Archaeology Department about his fieldwork studying the impact on sediments left behind by humans and their settlements.
And later, I chat to physicist and science communicator Frande, who works at the Department of Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics here in Cambridge.
So first, here's my interview with Ian.
My name's Sean. I'm interviewing for BlueSci. It's a BlueSci podcast. And Ian, would you like to introduce yourself?
Absolutely. So my name is Ian Osterreicher. I'm an archaeology PhD student here at Cambridge. I'm from Seattle originally, where I did my undergraduate work. And I specialize in geoarchaeology.
Right. Geoarchaeology. So what exactly is that then?
So it's a subfield of archaeology that focuses mostly on environments, landscapes, and using more earth science and geological methods to understand past processes in relation to human settlements mostly.
Okay, right. And so how did you get into that field?
Well, it was slightly by accident, probably as most people specialize by accident. I was on a field project when I was an undergrad, and there was a woman there who was doing a lot of soil micromorphology, which I'll talk about later. And I find that process really, really interesting because it doesn't just look at the material artifacts, but the context around those, and helps you build a better picture of how objects got to where they were, basically. And it seemed like a really fascinating approach to studying the past. So I decided that I would try and learn a little bit more about that. And then as an undergraduate, I focused mostly on this geoarchaeology. I later did a master's with that woman in Dublin, Helen Lewis, who's really remarkable and a wonderful scientist. So that's kind of how I fell into it. And then smaller and smaller field, I guess.
What was your undergrad? Was it archaeology or was it...
In the U.S., anthropology is the umbrella degree.
Right.
And within that, you have, you know, four subfields. So cultural anthropology, archaeology, biological anthropology, and linguistics. And so as an undergraduate, you have to take a selection of all those courses. But I mostly specialized in archaeology and biological archaeology. Or anthropology, rather. Hmm. So it was nice because you could really feel it out as well and say, yeah. Well, I kind of like this general approach, but do I actually like this subfield?
Yeah.
Turns out I did.
Sometimes I kind of wish it was more like that here. Okay, so and then you stayed here on this side of the water since then.
I have been, yeah. So after I finished my master's in Dublin, I came to Cambridge to work with Dr. Charles French, who's a professor at the Department of Archaeology here, who specializes in landscape reconstruction, especially soil micromorphology. He used to do a lot of work with snail identification, actually, as an environmental indicator in ancient sediments. And he runs a really wonderful lab here. We've got about 15 of us in there working on a variety of different time periods all over the world. Hmm. With slightly different specialisms. So it's really a great place to sit down and ask questions and say, you know, if you've got a sample that you're banging your head against the desk, you can ask one of the team, and they say, oh, yeah, I saw this in a cave in, you know, Sri Lanka or something. You know, so it's a great place to work. You don't want to work in isolation with these things because it's so interpretive as well, and that adds a lot of subjectivity. So you really need to make sure that you have enough expertise so you're not coming up with the wrong interpretation.
Hmm. So what is it exactly that you're looking? You're analyzing soil to find out about past human communities, mainly. Is that it?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's a couple different kind of avenues for doing this research. Micromorphology is the name given to mostly what I do, which is where you take an intact block of a soil or sediment, and then you impregnate that with a polymer resin. Essentially glues it up, gets into all the pore spaces, and preserves the structure of the soil. Then you cut a piece of that off with a really awesome diamond-tipped saw, which is one of my favorite aspects of the process because you feel really awesome. And then you glue that to a piece of glass, grind that down to about 30 microns thick, and then add a cover slip. It's a little bit more complicated than that because you can imagine hand grinding something down to 30 microns is a royal pain. And then from that section, you can then see the range of, you know, grain size. You can see where the clays are and how they fill in the pore spaces, if they do fill in the pore spaces. You can get a great sense of the mineralogy because at, you know, a thin section, you're looking at a slice through all of the different minerals present. So if you have just a polarizing light microscope, then you can really do a lot with that. Mm. So it's actually really remarkable what you can see just from a small thin section of soil or sediment. So you can take it two ways. One, within a settlement. So if you take one of these blocks from, say, a house floor, you'll be able to see all of the micro artifacts, all the small pieces of stuff, all the rubbish that was kind of trampled into the floor. You can also see, if it was a plastered floor, you can see the amount of times it was plastered during its life. You can see the composition of that plaster. You get and if you do this in a, you know, gridded systematic way throughout a settlement, which is a lot of work, but sometimes it's worth it, you can get a really great sense of actually how people lived inside their dwellings. So not just, this is a structure, people must have lived in here. Well, how actually is the lived experience? Do people move through the houses in certain ways? A lot of the ways in which we move through houses is culturally determined or culturally defined. So if you can access that, you might be able to access more, you know, larger questions about actually the people that were living in that house. So the other way to do it is looking kind of more in the hinterland of a site. So mostly for environmental reconstructions. It's a bit of a different approach, obviously, than looking at the sediments from inside of a house, because you're dealing with soil processes, you're dealing with different types of sediment transport mechanisms, and this is a lot more similar to an earth sciences approach. So this is more similar to the kind of soil micromorphology a soil scientist would do. And that's mostly looking at soil structure, the amount of organic material to mineral material, the amount of pore spaces, the way those pores are arranged, and how the clays are incorporated into that.
So do you have an example of a culturally determined way of moving through house, or something that you could tell from a thin section?
Well, let's see. It's kind of difficult to come up with a good case study off the top of my head. There's some houses in Serbia that I was doing a little bit of work with a couple of years ago, and they're really remarkable houses. It's a huge site. There might be as many as 800 mud brick houses, and they're all rectangular structures with little dividers. And it seems like there's actually a loft as well. So there's two ovens, and obviously they're all collapsed and stuff, so when you're excavating them, you're trying to kind of build the walls back up, you know, remove the wall material from the floor material and all this stuff, so it's not exactly obvious. And with micromorphology, it's quite handy because you can actually distinguish those stratigraphic sequences a little bit better and help us actually, you know, say, was this a loft area that was then collapsed, or, you know, is this just an effect of the collapse? In terms of actually moving around those houses, no, I wasn't able to really see something super striking anyway. It generally occurs in a similar way, to be honest, around cooking areas and around, you know, sleeping areas. I was working in the Orkney Islands for my master's project, and there I was interested in the idea of hygiene and cleanliness. Some of you might know that up in the Orkney Islands, there's a very unique type of architecture where midden material, or decayed organic matter, often bones and, you know, food refuse materials, were actually decomposed and used as a as an insulating agent. So you'd basically build your house with two walls, and then inside those walls you'd fill it with this material. And then that midden material was also spread around the site as well. So I was interested in the degree of kind of what we would term cleanliness of these different areas. And I found that in some of the kind of main living areas outside of the houses, the main traffic areas, there was quite a lot of wood ash, but not a whole lot of kind of really rotted organic humic matter that you'd associate with something that would be really stinky, for example. So, you know, is this potentially people, you know, cleaning these surfaces with wood ash, fire ash, which is often used as a way to soak up smells? Now, I can't really say 100% accuracy from my small survey there, but that's one of those really kind of cool examples of what you can find from there. I hope that kind of gives some sort of perspective on the kind of way we work.
No, that's really cool. No, it's interesting. I didn't really know a lot about this, you know. Because as an earth scientist myself, you know, you're often thinking about a lot of the things layer up and how they might have experienced, you know, the path of time. But I've never thought about that. It's a shorter scale.
Yeah, and, exactly.
And the human impact. Such a record. And so field work's a big part of your work, obviously.
Field work is huge. Yeah, I personally absolutely love field work. It's why I'm absolutely happiest. I definitely would have to say that I became an archaeologist for the field work. That's a big component. I mean, that's where how I fell in love with it anyway, was being in the field and actually doing the work. So it kind of makes a lot of sense. But I'm quite lucky in that within geoarchaeology, it's quite applicable to around the globe. So I don't specialize in, you know, ancient Minoan pottery, which, not to lambast that, it's a great thing to do, but it does mean that you'd have to be studying Minoan pottery, and you can only be in one place to do that. So I can quite happily move from Mongolia to Egypt to the UK, to the US and Philippines, these kinds of places, and still have enough expertise to say something meaningful.
As long as there's soil?
As long as there's dirt, I'm there. Yeah.
No, that's cool. Yeah, so where have you been most recently then?
Most recently was a small field project in the Fayum Oasis in Egypt. So this is a natural basin that fills up with Nile river water, and at flood season, when it was flood season before all of the, you know, water control, it would be connected to the Nile. Now it exists as a very large lake, home to tons of wonderful birds, and it's a really beautiful landscape as well. So the Fayum area is a big agricultural spot in modern day Egypt, and it was also in the past. So it was quite an important place in the past. So this project, I was invited out by Dr. Judith Bunbury, who's here at Cambridge as well in Earth Sciences, and we were looking at this New Kingdom palace, which was the harem palace supposedly of Amenhotep III. So this is where his wives would have lived, I suppose. I'm not an Egyptologist, so anything I say about the specifics of the archaeology should be taken with salt. probably gypsum, because there's tons and tons of gypsum in the sediments there. But what we were looking for was to see the relationship between any ancient river channels to this palace. So in the texts, there's mention of a harbor, and the project director wanted to find out the nature of this harbor. Was it a true harbor, or was it just a stick that you could tie a boat up to? Right. So Judith and I and our colleague Mustafa El-Wakil from the Geology Institute in Cairo went out there and used a series of kind of semi-systematic boreholing. So we would use a hand auger and drill down 10 centimeters at a time, about 10 to 15 centimeters, pull that sample out, describe its texture, its basic mineralogy, and sort through it, sift it, and look for any diagnostic artifacts, generally pieces of pottery. As you get deeper and deeper, you can tell, obviously, quite obviously, whether or not this was a water lane sediment or whether or not it was, you know, windblown. And it's quite interesting as well, because next to this palace, if you have water lane sediment, kind of slow moving water lane sediment, and within that you have a very angular piece of ceramic pottery, you know that pottery hasn't traveled very far on the surface, and it hasn't been exposed for very long on the surface, because it would have been eroded down. Exactly, it would have been rounded. So that's one way in which we can link artifacts to the place. And obviously, it transported a little bit down the hill into the water. But yes, from that really nice little tiny tenuous bit of evidence, you can say, oh yeah, actually, there was some sort of water right here at this time. And thankfully, the Egyptian ceramic analysts are so good. And the New Kingdom Egyptian ceramics were very much related to who was in power at the time. Mm. So you can say with a lot of accuracy that this is actually temporally related. So that was quite cool. It was a lot of fun. And it's also one of those fun times where, you know, your analysis comes right out of the ground. Yeah. Because you're working in Egypt, you can't remove any samples. So it really limits what you can do scientifically with the material. So a lot of it is, you know, just using a hand lens and using your fingers and getting dirty. And, it's really rewarding. It's a lot of fun. But I do kind of wish I could actually take micromorphology samples and say a little bit more about the nature of this river. But such is life.
No, that's really cool. Do you have any other standout moments from your field work?
I think, that was a really fun little bit of field work. I think probably one of the first things that really hooked me in archaeology was I was in the Philippines working for the University of the Philippines, Diliman. I was a field school. And I was out there, and I was tasked with basically mapping the insides of these limestone caves, this big cave system, and identifying where there were jar burials. So about 1,000 years ago, people would cremate the body and put them in a little clay vessel and tuck them way, way back into these caves, into these little limestone hollows. So it was quite an it really spoke to my 19-year-old adventurous spirit, where I thought I was really cool and climbing around inside these caves. It was just so much fun as well. So I was just kind of worming my way through these caves, and some of the passages are really tiny and stuff. And so I had my headlamp and a little lighter to make sure there was enough oxygen and stuff. So it was me, and I was mostly alone when I would go back into some of these passages, but I obviously had a couple other people with me. And there were a lot of fun times from there, you know, encountering these gigantic spiders and all manner of, horrible things roaming around in bat feces, which was not fun. I was going to say it was quite fun. It wasn't fun. Yeah. But that's probably one of the things that made me want to pursue archaeology, not necessarily because it had anything to do with what I do now. academically. But because it's a kind of a nice, I almost drew a really horribly extended metaphor for searching through caves for searching back in time, but I'm not going to say that. It's that type of exploration, both academically and, you know, in the physical world. It's what I really like to do, and archaeology is really the perfect marriage of that type of expedition, because you have a very physical aspect of it, then you also have a very cerebral engagement with it as well. And it's a wonderful thing to do. A lot of fun. No money in it, though. Too bad.
Okay, thanks again to Ian for talking to us. That was a really enjoyable interview. Next up, we've got the research highlights, and that's Emma.
Yeah, so, did you know that prehistoric humans did cranial surgery?
I did not.
Yeah, neither did I. So, actually, the evidence of human cranial surgery that date back to the Mesolithic. That's the middle period of the Stone Age, so several thousand years before the Common Era. Quite a long time ago.
Yeah.
So we don't really know why. It could have been for medical reasons, or possibly kind of religious rituals. Amazingly, actually, those remains show that even then, humans had a lot of dexterity and a lot of knowledge of the surgical techniques that they were doing, which obviously that raises the question of how such practical knowledge was acquired. So one possibility is that they trained on live animals. So finding intact or complete animal skulls from that era is really rare, mainly because animals' tongues and brains would have been used for food, and so obviously people would have had to break open the skull to access them.
Right.
However, this group published a paper in Scientific Reports earlier in April, where they studied a almost complete 5,000 to 5,500-year-old skull from a cow, which was found in France. And this skull has a hole in the frontal lobe. So it's about 6.5 centimetres long and 4.5 centimetres wide, which, incidentally, according to some cross-referencing I did with a paper called Hand Measurements Data from Human Babies at Birth, is slightly bigger than a newborn's hand.
Wow.
So I digress a little bit, but it's quite small. So it was originally thought that this hole was possibly caused by goring by another cow. However, the scientists studied the skull using scanning electron microscopy and like 3D reconstruction, and they can't see any evidence of fracture around the hole, which you would expect to see if it had been caused by kind of blunt trauma.
Right.
Instead, what they describe in the paper are these sort of parallel marks around the hole, which basically look like cut marks, as if the bone had been intensively scraped. So most likely this hole was actually man-made and might have been some sort of like prehistoric surgeon training.
I bet.
So it's basically the earliest example of surgical experimentation on an animal that has ever been reported. So yeah. Skull surgery on a cow 5,000 years ago, which I thought was a little bit insane.
Yeah, wow.
So, yeah.
I don't think I would have wanted to get my head cut open 5,000 years ago. Not today, I think.
Okay, so moving away from prehistorical brain surgery and into modern theoretical physics, I interviewed Fran Day about her work. She's also a stand-up comedian, and so we talked a lot about that as well. It was a really interesting interview. I learned a lot. We also talked about gender bias in STEM, so I hope you find it interesting as well. I'm very happy to be joined today by Fran Day. He's a particle physicist and a junior research fellow at Peterhouse College in Cambridge. Hi.
Hello.
Thanks for coming on the podcast. So I thought we could just start this discussion by talking a little bit about what your work is in general in very broad terms that I can understand.
Sure. So I'm an astroparticle physicist. Mm-hmm. And this means broadly that I'm using telescope observations to try to find out more about particle physics.
Mm-hmm.
Which might seem a bit weird because I'm looking at like really big things that are in space and then trying to find out about really tiny things, mm-hmm. like subatomic particles. But actually we can create conditions in space, like very, very high energies or very, very high densities, for example, that we could never create on Earth. And therefore, it's actually a very sensible thing to do because you can create extreme conditions that you couldn't do on Earth. So in particular, I'm looking for particles called axions or axion-like particles, which are predicted to exist by string theory.
Mm-hmm.
And which could also make up the dark matter. So dark matter is matter that we know exists because we can see its gravitational pull on other matter, but we don't know anything else about it, like what it is. So I'm looking for kind of what that could be.
Right. And so when you say string theory, what do you mean by that?
Okay, so string theory is probably the leading candidate for what we call a theory of everything. So that would be something that explains both particle physics and what we know about gravity, so general relativity, that kind of thing. It can reproduce both of those. And it does this by describing different particles as different modes of vibration on strings, essentially. So in the same way as if you have a violin string, you can have different notes on that string when it's vibrating differently.
Mm-hmm.
Different particles would roughly correspond to those different vibration patterns.
Right. And so what would your, like, standard day look like?
So one thing I do is read papers that other scientists have written. It's really important to keep up with other scientists' research, chat to people and think about things. That's the most fun part, when you just get to do the kind of big ideas, thinking. And then I also do a lot of programming to kind of enact my ideas. I do some data analysis, unusually for a theoretical physicist. So I often look at data from X-ray telescopes and I'll analyse that and do simulations based on axions or dark matter and compare those. And then also I write things, so I write papers as well, you know, hopefully.
What attracted you to physics in particular? I'm not questioning your life choices.
It's hard to say. I mean, I don't remember not knowing that I wanted to be a physicist.
Right.
So I've really wanted to be a physicist since I was like 4. Because it really, physics deals with the most fundamental stage of the universe. You know, you keep asking like why and why and why, you get to physics. Mm-hmm. And because I'm doing work on fundamental particles, I'm at the most fundamental end of physics. So it's really at the sort of bleeding edge of what we know and how stuff works. And I find that really exciting and really motivating.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I was particularly excited to talk to you because you also do a lot of stand-up comedy.
Yep.
And I think you describe yourself as a science comedian.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you get into comedy originally?
So I used to be actually very shy, and I didn't like giving talks or any kind of public speaking. And when you do a career in science, you always have to give talks and interviews and describe your work to people. So I thought I needed to get better at public speaking. And this was during the first year of my PhD in Oxford. So I had this kind of self-imposed challenge that anytime there was an opportunity to do public speaking, I'd have to say yes to it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we all got an email around the department from an organisation called Bright Club.
Yeah.
And they facilitate academics to do stand-up comedy about their research. So according to my like self-imposed rule, I had to say yes to this. So I thought, you know, what's the worst that can happen, right? It's only 8 minutes and they provide training and it's a really friendly night. So I did that, and it was so much fun. It's so much easier than giving scientific talks. Because you can't be wrong, right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't really matter if people don't understand you as long as they find you funny. So many advantages. So then I did that, and it really just went from there.
Cool. So, yeah, I think if you took someone in the street and you asked them, like, what they associate science with, like, some people might say it's interesting, some people might say it's cool,
some people might say it's complicated, but I don't think like funny would necessarily be kind of among that list. So what do you like about merging these two things together?
I think particularly the kind of science I do can border on the absurd. So I study axions, for example, and different theoretical physicists study different particles. So you might have heard of things like supersymmetry, WIMPs, right-handed neutrinos. There's all these like wacky ideas. And, you know, probably most of them don't exist. You're spending a lot of time on these like strange ideas that don't exist and trying to work out the consequences of them. And particularly in the field now, almost all of the data that's coming out of the Large Hadron Collider is consistent with the standard model, so consistent with our current understanding of particles, and doesn't require new particles to explain it. So there's really a dearth of things to explain, which really, means you're in a situation where people are just being like, oh, there's this particle and this particle and this particle. And it's a really important thought process because we do know that there are things that need explaining. But it is also pretty funny. they're trying to, like, come up with all this random stuff that doesn't exist.
Do you see comedy as also a way of communicating science to people?
Yeah. So when I do science comedy, I think of it primarily as entertainment. But there's a secondary aim of communicating science to people. And I really try to communicate, you know, what science is.
Yeah.
I think that a lot of science communication today focuses on, you know, look how big space is, or like, look how fast we can accelerate protons. At least physics communication. There are different issues in biology, for example. And that's great, and that certainly has a place, but that doesn't, for example, explain the scientific method, and it doesn't explain what the day-to-day life of a scientist is like. And the really interesting parts of science aren't just about big numbers or very small numbers, they're really about how stuff works. But to do that, but make it entertaining and like something somebody would want to do on a Friday night, I think you have to add a little bit extra to it, like human interest or comedy. Or so it really helps me explain bits of science that sometimes don't get explained.
Do you find that there are skills that you learned from being a scientist that you use in comedy, or vice versa?
Yeah, definitely. So the big one is creativity. So I write all my own material, and that is obviously a very creative process. I think everyone would recognise that. But science is also incredibly creative. And sometimes people have this image that science is just like really robotic. But actually, if you're trying to create a theory to explain some data, that's a hugely creative process. Or even if you're just trying to write a program to do a particular task, that's actually also really creative, you know, how you do that best.
Moving away a little bit from comedy aspect of science, we've actually had quite a lot of female guests on the podcast so far. It hasn't really been a conscious decision. That's just how it happened. But obviously that's not particularly reflective of the gender bias that there is in the scientific profession at the moment. And I think especially not in physics. Is that something you or aware of, like, kind of on a day-to-day basis? Is that something that's ever bothered you, or do you tend to kind of just move past the fact that a lot of the people around you tend to be men, for example?
So, I mean, it's certainly noticeable that everyone's a man.
Yeah.
Not quite everyone, but it's, you know, very, very often the case that if, you know, we're at coffee or at lunch, that I'll be the only woman there, because theoretical physics is very, very male-dominated. Obviously, I'm used to it on a day-to-day basis. I don't really think about it. It's just the way it is. I think, you know, I certainly think it's a shame. You see that in some countries, there are many more women doing theoretical physics. And therefore, it's very clear that it's possible for more women to do it, and it would be great if more women did it, because we're just missing out on some people that might be really good at it and really enjoy it.
Yeah.
You know, we're not choosing from the full pool of talent.
How do you think that could be addressed? Is there anything in like particular that you think should be changed in a way physics is portrayed, for example?
There's certainly not one thing.
Yeah.
It's just like, do that and it'll be fine. I think it's clear that, particularly in the case of physics, it starts very early on. I think that there's a huge amount of gendering that goes on, you know, when a child is two or three, in terms of what toys they're given and how people talk to them. And that really just feeds into later life. You know, you see science kits in, like, boys' sections.
Yeah.
And you see, you know, people going up to little girls and saying, oh, look how pretty you are. And, like, people going up to little boys and saying, like, oh, you know, you're a brave boy or you're a clever boy. And it's just that kind of thing, which may seem like really small incidents, just really seeps into you when it's all the time. So I think that is one of the biggest things we can do.
Brilliant. Okay, so before we go, I had some quickfire round questions for you.
Yep.
Favourite scientist?
Oh, that's really difficult. Can I choose Ada Lovelace, who's more of a computer scientist? But so she was really key in the development of computer programming. I just think, firstly, really a pioneering woman, and it's really impossible to overstate the importance of the computer for allowing scientific research to progress. Nothing I do would be possible without a computer. It just allows you to make predictions and analyse data in a way that just wouldn't work otherwise.
Yeah. Favourite comedian?
John Finnemore.
Okay, I don't know who he is.
So he does kind of sketch shows for Radio 4. There's John Finnemore's Souvenir Programme, and he wrote a kind of comedy radio sitcom called Cabin Pressure. I just think he's hilarious. I think he's the cleverest writer around at the moment. Plus a Peter House alumnus.
Favourite science fact?
Wow.
If you have one.
Okay. I think one thing that was really exciting for me was learning about quantum field theory and the structure of the Standard Model, and the fact that the structures we see in the particles that exist are explained by their symmetry groups. So they're explained by imposing a particular symmetry that you want there to be in nature, then the particles all come from that. No one really knows why it's like that, but it's pretty cool that it is, and it's, yeah, certainly an avenue to more exciting physics.
Favourite joke?
Oh, wow.
Sorry, this is really hard.
Yeah. So I don't really write jokes. I do anecdotal comedy, but I can do ones that other people have written.
Uh-huh.
Okay, this one's cute.
Okay.
Why do Marxists drink herbal tea?
No, I don't.
Because property is theft.
Good. And then favourite science joke.
Okay, this one's like slightly niche, but I figure some of the audience of this podcast would be physicists.
Yeah.
So I think I've read this one in The Guardian. And you can commute the genders of this joke to make it like, you know, more inclusive. A woman comes home to find her string theorist husband in bed with another woman. And she says, what on earth are you doing? And he says, but honey, I can explain everything.
Very good. Okay. And then last question. Science or comedy?
That's really tricky. Obviously, I want to do both forever.
Yeah.
I want to be... Like, do you know Victoria Coren Mitchell?
Yeah.
I want to be like her, but yeah, instead of poker, theoretical physics. And not married to David Mitchell.
Cool. I think that's a great place to leave it. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us.
No worries. It was really fun.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Thanks again to our guests for speaking to us today and to you guys for tuning in.
Yep, thanks a lot. If you want to contact us, you can find us on Twitter at BlueSkyPod. And
you can send us an email at bluesidepodcast@gmail.com.
Thank you.
You can also find the BlueSide website on blueside.co.uk. And if you're in Cambridge, look out in departments and faculties for the upcoming edition of BlueSci, which will come out in the next couple of weeks.
It's got an article by Emma in it. Go read it.
Bye-bye.
See ya.